Welcome to episode 143 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
Hi, I'm Gary Ferencik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. There are a couple of non-medically related anniversaries that are coming up on this day. First, kind of interesting bookends from the entertainment world. Walt Disney was born on this day, and Mozart died on this day. December 5th is the day we're recording. And this was also the day that Martin Luther King organized the Montgomery bus boycott. So lots of fascinating things happened on this date.
Thanks, Henry. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want to get them all, subscribe to Essential Evidence Plus. You'll get a POEM every day in your email, plus a great primary care reference. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any products. You can get CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians. Just go to IAFP.com, click on their education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, we'll discuss a possible new agent for acne, analgesia in adults with renal colic, breast cancer overdiagnosis, and blood pressure cuff size. Kate.
Hi, I'm excited to be here. I have one of these amazing unhinged articles that make me both doubt and hope for the future of medicine at the same time. I don't think I have enjoyed getting sucked into an article so much since the one that we covered a few years ago about laser therapy for postmenopausal vaginal symptoms. This article isn't quite as good, but it was a phase two trial looking at the use of something called DMT-310, which is a powdered mixture of a freshwater sponge, Spongilla lacustris, the Latin name, to treat acne. Why, you might reasonably ask, would anyone on earth sink money into that? Apparently, I learned it has been used to treat inflammatory conditions since the 18th century, and the article states, without any irony, that the Russian Ministry of Health reports that 1.5 million people use it every year in that country to treat acne without any side effects. So that is their basis for pursuing this study. The proposed mechanism of action is that the sponge spicules penetrate the top layer of the skin and improve the absorption of some kind of unnamed active anti-inflammatory components. So these investigators took 181 patients age 12 or older who met standard diagnostic criteria for moderate to severe acne vulgaris. That will be important in a second. They were randomly allocated to receive either the active product topically or a matched placebo. They rubbed it into their entire skin on the face, avoiding the mucous membranes once a week for 12 weeks. It was left on for 10 to 15 minutes, then washed off. Outcome assessors remained masked to the treatment group, so this was a supposedly triple-blinded study. So what they found was that there was a statistically significant difference in the reduction of the number of inflammatory lesions as well as non-inflammatory acne lesions between the treatment group and the control group. They have a couple of different scales, which will take me too much time to explain what they were, but they were statistically significant, probably clinically meaningful if we got right down to it. There were significantly more patients in the active treatment group that achieved what they described as success, which was the use of a standardized acne scale, a number needed to treat of about four. There were low reports of adverse events in both groups, about 15% versus about 9%. Similarly, low rates of dropout in both groups. As part of my intensive Googling of this agent, I did find that the drug company did a very similar trial looking at acne rosacea, not acne vulgaris. The results were not statistically significant. So this is not a universal effect, not a class effect. As you know, we treat the acne of acne rosacea very much like we treat the acne of acne vulgaris in most cases. I thought it was also worth noting that you can get a six pack of Spongilla masks on Amazon for $19.99. So this really is used. You do have to import them from Russia, but so be it. So we'll see if this becomes a phase three and then an FDA-approved product to treat acne. Henry?
Well, when I was a teenager, my mother told me that I was supposed to wash my face and my hands and to use this and to use a washcloth and really get in there and scrub real hard. And so the big question is, you know, we've is whether or not this is unique to this specific product, or is this an exfoliation type thing? Because remember the little scrubbing bubbles and other acne washes that were popular for a long time? It's all part of the same part and parcel, I think. So I don't think it's necessarily that this is all that unique. You know, the numbers needed to treat look pretty good. The question is whether they're too good to be true, especially since it didn't have any effect on acne rosacea, which, you know, raises a few red flags. I think the concept is correct, though, and this probably doesn't offer anything that's all that terribly newsworthy.
Okay, so listeners, send Henry your spongilla masks for Christmas. Okay, he'll be happy to get
them. Hey, what about eyelid sagging? Does that help? You know, they have the little bags under your eye and your deep Google dive. Kate, did you find anything about, you know, being useful for plastic surgery, so to speak?
I did not actually Google that, but I will bring that back to you next time. You know, I live in a house with teenagers, so this is kind of my jam.
It's once a week. It's once a week. It's 20 bucks. What could go wrong?
So they actually said that was part of their, they like one of the first few things that they say in the article is that they said adherence to acne therapy is a big issue. So the once weekly was supposed to be one of their selling points. But I think it's actually harder sometimes to do something once a week than it is to do it once a day. You forget. Like, yeah, it's Friday again.
Was it a U.S. trial? Was the study done in the U.S.?
Well, that's a good question. I don't remember.
Yeah, I'm just sure. Looking at the name. The names look like a fairly diverse bunch of names, which is typical for a U.S. study, so it probably was. Huh, interesting.
So the other question is whether or not this would be any better than loofah or any of the other sponge products that are out there.
That's the next study. Kate, you got the quiz for us.
Oh, I sure do. Quick one today. According to a 2012 review article, what was wrong with Tiny Tim of Dickens fame? Was it A, cerebral palsy, B, a tethered spinal cord, C, vitamin D deficiency, D, tuberculosis, or E, renal tubular acidosis? Stay tuned.
Wow, how interesting. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Mark, do you know the answer to this?
I haven't snuck it ahead, and I have no clue what the answer is. So
The real thing that was wrong with him is none of the above, that he was born into the wrong family.
Okay. Thanks, Henry. It's your turn now to talk about renal colic.
Leave this fictional.
A subject that's near and dear to my heart.
Too near and dear.
Yeah, I've had a few stones over the years, including during our most recent podcast, which was why I was, or a couple podcasts ago, which was why I missed. This is an interesting network meta-analysis that tried to compare three specific intravenous agents. And that's not all of the possible analgesics that are out there for patients with renal colic. They tried to look at studies that looked at intravenous acetaminophen, ketorolac, ketamine versus morphine. Okay. They looked at all of the usual databases and reference lists to try to really saturate the potential studies. And the main outcomes would be the usual things that we would be looking at. Changes in a pain visual analog score, rescue medication use, and adverse events. They were only able to find 12 studies with 2,800 adults, so relatively small data set. Things got a bit complicated because some of the therapies actually included morphine in combination with other agents. And so I don't know, Mark, you taught network meta-analysis, and maybe you can comment about how easy it is to tease out the independent effects in that kind of situation. They did the best that they could with what was out there. When they looked at all of the data, it turns out that at 15 minutes, 30 minutes, and 60 minutes, those were the time frames, that morphine really did not do well. Compared with morphine at 15 minutes, everything else was about the same. At about a half an hour, the patients who received ketorolac or acetaminophen were a little bit better on the visual analog scale, 1.5 and 1 point difference, net difference, which are of borderline clinical significance. At the end of an hour, though, it's only the ones that had ketorolac that actually had significant pain reductions, a total of a net effect of 3 points on the visual analog scale. Oh, by the way, this is part of the recurring theme that we've seen over the last couple of years, that morphine, like other opiates, were more likely to be associated with adverse events, but also more likely to require rescue therapy. So when I was passing my most recent stones, I didn't have parenteral anything. I did not go to the emergency room. I just loaded up on Tylenol and liquids. So that would be consistent with at least some of the data in this study.
Were you balled up like a baby puking in the toilet?
Not this time.
TMI. TMI. Nobody wants to know.
Yeah. Well, I learned recently that I have a kidney stone sitting up there in my renal, in my left kidney, I think. So hopefully it'll just stay there. That's what I'm counting on. We'll see. But good study. You can't, if patients are randomized to, let's say, morphine plus ketorolac versus ketorolac alone, then that's a separate comparison from morphine versus ketorolac or morphine versus placebo. So you'd have to treat that separately, I think. Hopefully they did. Kate, any comments about this one?
No, it seems totally consistent with what we've sort of long known about treating renal colic.
Yeah, this study's probably been done about a gazillion times, hasn't it? I mean, it just seems like dating back decades. This study has just been replicated 5 or 6 times. You know, it's not so much which one is better. I mean, it gets sequenced. Like you, Henry, I've been a victim twice of kidney stones. You know, ketorolac, doesn't work. You move on to the other agents. I mean, I don't know. It just almost like seems a study that probably doesn't need to be studied anymore.
Okay, we'll tell them to stop.
Would you please? Would you go on to
those? I'll contact the authorities.
This was a network meta-analysis. Yeah. So this was a meta-analysis. They didn't just go and do the study and replicate. They just tried to take advantage of the data that's already out there.
Well, tell them to study something more important.
There are more systematic reviews published than there are randomized trials in any given year. Yeah. Often on the same topic. So it's a thing. Anyway, I'm going to talk a little bit about breast cancer overdiagnosis. This was a study in Annals of Internal Medicine by Richmond and colleagues called Estimating Breast Cancer Overdiagnosis After Screening Mammography Among Older Women in the United States. So this is what the epidemiologists like to call a target trial, where they used observational data and they imagined an ideal randomized trial and then tried to simulate it using this previously collected data. So to do that, they used the SEER Medicare Cancer Registry, and they found 54,000 women older than 70 years who'd had a screening mammogram in 2002. And they then followed them forward for up to 15 years. And they used a two-step approach. First, they identified women over 70 who had a negative screening result in 2002 and were therefore designated to be cancer-free. They then followed these women to see if they did or did not have another mammogram in the next 3 years, and then whether they had a subsequent diagnosis of breast cancer. So the difference in incidence of breast cancer in the screen detected group was compared with the incidence in those who didn't get screened and whose breast cancer was therefore diagnosed due to symptoms without having had a screening mammogram. So kind of a complicated methodology. So the bottom line is overdiagnosis, which is the identification in this example of breast cancer that wouldn't have caused symptoms in a person's lifetime, does seem to increase with age. They found overdiagnosis rates ranging from 31% in women 70 to 74 to 51% in women over age 85 who were screened. So these are, and this makes sense also because as men and women get older, there are more competing causes of mortality. So there's more chance that something else would shorten a person's life or end a person's life other than the breast cancer. There may also be differences in how aggressive cancers are at various ages. So certainly seems like the rate of overdiagnosis is higher, and you'd have to think pretty carefully before continuing to screen, I think, beyond the age of 75. So, Gary?
Yeah, I mean, the analogy for prostate cancer is almost exactly the same in men. And it's hard to know what to do about this. Now, I feel a lot more confident in my prostate cancer screening knowledge than breast cancer. But even if this is true, when you try to explain this to a patient, it becomes really muddy because, yeah, well, it might be overdiagnosis, but on the other hand, maybe it's not. And it's part of informed decision making. I understand that. But on the other hand, boy, it's really a difficult concept, I think, in plain language, to have patients understand this and how it might impact their health one way or another. I think what this reminds me of, Mark, is it doesn't matter what you do in medicine, there's downside. If you screen for breast cancer, there's downside. If you don't screen for breast cancer, there's downside. And in some ways, it's trying to help patients understand the concept of what downside are they most willing to live with. And I'm much more confident, like I said, in my prostate cancer education for the patients in terms of this idea of downside. But this is, again, I think this is, brilliant data. It's just hard to know how to implement this.
Yeah, obviously we need more and better biomarkers and other indicators of when a cancer is likely to be indolent versus aggressive. In this study, one other thing is they did not find any difference in breast cancer-related death between the screened and unscreened patients. And I think that's also an important thing to note. Kate, any comments on this one?
Yeah, I do a lot of breast cancer screening counseling. And I think by and large, people are much more willing to accept a risk of overdiagnosis, possibly in part because they don't understand it necessarily. You understand a diagnosis, but less so that risk of harm. Even if you understand that, you may not have a lower risk of mortality from breast cancer, just the idea of having cancer scares people. So then they're much more willing to accept screening if that means that they won't have cancer. And I think the other troubling thing about overdiagnosis is that there's no way to know if this is going to be a cancer, a very deadly cancer that, you might ultimately die from versus like a cancer, but you're going to die from something else until you're dead. And so, there's figuring out, is this the cancer that we really want to catch and find out about? Or is this a cancer that we don't need to know about? That's hard to know at the moment of making that screening decision. So overdiagnosis is tricky.
Yeah. And there are different ways that a cancer becomes overdiagnosed. And, here we're talking a lot about this competing causes reason where somebody has a heart attack rather than dying of breast cancer. But on the other hand, you also have some cancers grow much more slowly than others. And we see that with prostate cancer. And fortunately, we have some tools with prostate cancer like the Gleason score. And increasingly, I think we're getting biomarkers for breast cancers in terms of aggressiveness. And, hopefully we can eventually get to the point where we can maybe do active surveillance for some men and women rather than immediate aggressive treatment. But I think we're still a ways off from that. All right, Gary, tell us about blood pressure cuffs.
Yeah, I was struck this week by what I wanted to continue on my blood pressure theme or use the hearing aid abstract that actually just came out in people's emails today. So I chose this one. This was published in JAMA Internal Medicine earlier this year, and it was entitled The Effects of Cuff Size. So miscuffing is really the key here. Cuff size on the accuracy of blood pressure readings. It was the CUFF-SC randomized crossover trial. So they took community-dwelling 195 adults, various sizes of arms in Baltimore, who underwent four sets of triplicate blood pressure measurements using an automated oscilloscope. These cuffs were appropriate for the patient's arm, so they measured it appropriately. They also used in part of their study design, cuffs that were measured to be deliberately too small or deliberately too arm for the respective cuff sizes, and they applied them in random order. And it turned out that what they then did was to ask the question, when you compare the appropriate size cuff, what kind of an error are you getting with either too small or too large of a cuff? I think one of the early interesting results of the study was that when we look at the regular size adult cuff, only 28% of the people in the study actually qualified for that. So most people needed, quite frankly, a larger cuff. More than 55% of them did. So the main finding was that using a regular size cuff on individuals who required a small cuff, kind of a minuscule reading in terms of the systolic blood pressure, about 4 millimeters of mercury. However, if you used a regular size cuff in somebody who required either a large or an extra large cuff, you started getting into perhaps clinically meaningful differences. It was only 5 millimeters if you had a patient who needed a large cuff, but it was 20 millimeters of mercury difference in terms of the systolic blood pressure in those who required an extra large cuff, but in whom a regular adult size cuff was actually used. So that has a very, potentially could, influence management and pharmacotherapy. So a good methodological strength. So it was randomized crossover design meant to minimize the effect bias of order and control for individual variability in blood pressure measurements using this oscilloscope. There's a diverse participation and recruitment from various locations, broad range of arm sizes included in the study, and they used a very rigorous and standardized blood pressure measurement protocol, ensuring consistency and reliability of the data collection. Some of the weaknesses may have been insufficient sample sizes in certain groups, self-reported BMI, they didn't actually measure the BMI, that could have introduced accuracies or biases. And may not, of course, extend to the real-world setting in which blood pressure is not typically done by a research-trained control staff. So long story short, this is yet another of the many, many, many articles. We're talking about the articles on renal colic earlier that look at errors in measurement of blood pressure. And this is such a common thing that we do over and over and over again. And it seems like at some point we should be able to get this right. And oh, by the way, I wanted listeners to hear.
Hey, did you write this, Gary? Did you write this? Wait a minute.
It does not sound like Gary. So I took this article. So those of you, I think this is the first time I mentioned it on the podcast, but I've done a deep dive in artificial intelligence over the last 8 weeks, and I am just absolutely blown away. So one of the things I was talking to Mark last week about, I said, hey, I'm going to take this article, and I'm going to have AI assist me in analyzing this article so I can present it. So I put the ChatGPT, put in the reference. It says, hey, I said in 350 words or less, give me the methodology, the main findings, the methodological weaknesses and strengths, and which I didn't talk about was the contributions to existing knowledge. And again, it just killed it. I mean, it just did a great job on this. I mean, I went back and looked at the article. I looked at the abstract that Alan wrote as well, and there's really no errors in this particular one. I did buff it up a little bit for readability, but for the most part, I'd say 85% of this was created by ChatGPT.
All right. We'll be nice to have you on the podcast, Gary. We'll be having ChatGPT take your place.
Yet another example of how AI is going to make me lose my job. Darn it.
Well, yeah. Ha ha. Don't go into diagnostic radiology would be my advice. Kate, any comments about this, Kate, first?
Yeah, I guess I'm wondering, did they know from the start that the participants, it said that they knew that they needed a different size cuff and they went ahead and they used the wrong size anyways, and then they were measuring to find out if it didn't work?
Actually, it was one of these things where they invited in a whole bunch of, quote unquote, community dwelling adults, all of whom had different arm sizes. They said, hey, what we want to do is to measure blood pressure on three separate occasions, too small, regular, too large, and see what happens. So it wasn't like they came into the study knowing that they were going to use one cuff or the other. They used all three cuffs on all 195 participants.
And they were just trying to see how much variability there is.
Yeah, just think about it as miscuffing, right? When you use the wrong cuff for the wrong arm, you get the wrong answer. Who knew?
You keep using that like it's a real word. And I don't think it is.
Miscuffing? Google it. Better yet, go to AI and type it in. Miscuffing.
I'm not going to do that either.
So the word of the year is Riz. Okay. Anybody know what Riz means? You have kids. You should know what Riz means.
I absolutely do. I guess that makes sense. And I guess the bottom line about use the right size, equipment for the job that you're doing.
It seems like duh. There's a lot of research articles that are duh.
Yeah, so Gary, you've hit. We've talked about this quite a bit over the years. This is not terribly newsworthy. It points out the fallacy of the measurement approach that we take. We have the indirect approach, which is what we use with blood pressure cuffs, versus direct, which involves arterial catheters, which are certainly not feasible. So the big question is, are there new technologies that are coming down the line that might allow us to overcome many of the potential sources of measurement error? And in the meantime, I also did some trying to think this through from a nuanced perspective. I'm not married to a physicist, but Kate is, and I'm sure I've got many aspects of this wrong. So I first started off with what's the volume of a cylinder? okay? And that's pi r squared times the length, okay? So small changes in the radius, if you will, small changes will represent a large diameter in terms of volume. So then the next question becomes, what about flow and pressure? And so you could either use Bernoulli's equation or Poiseuille's law of laminar flow. And all of those, what you see are the radius is a part of that. And so small changes, small errors represent huge potential number differences. So this is something you could share with your friends at cocktail parties about why it's important to get the cup size correct.
You go to
another reason I don't
parties.
Go to cocktail parties.
It does sound like the cocktail parties I get dragged to.
Okay, Kate, you get to talk about the answer to the quiz next, which is fascinating.
Yes. According to a 2012 review article, the question was, what was wrong with Tiny Tim? Was it cerebral palsy, a tethered spinal cord, vitamin D deficiency, tuberculosis, or renal tubular acidosis? Now, we know, courtesy of Dickens himself, that Tim was small, he used a crutch, he wore leg braces, and that his condition would be fatal if not intervened upon. This 2012 article from the journal that became JAMA Pediatrics argues that Tiny Tim was suffering from a combination of rickets and tuberculosis. So TB was endemic in Victorian London. It was present in about half of people, while a combination of poor diet and catastrophic environmental factors led to widespread rickets. The hypothesis was also advanced by the fact that Dickens implies that Tim's condition would be reversible or improved with interventions such as a benevolent Scrooge reversing his behavior, which also limits the pool of potential diagnoses to things that could be reversible. So that is the answer, combination of vitamin D deficiency leading to rickets and tuberculosis.
All right.
Wait a minute. Who got that right?
I did not.
I just want to make sure we acknowledge that, you know, I didn't read ahead, by the way.
Yeah, I was going with cerebral palsy was my guess, but anyway, I'm not as smart as Dr. Chesney or Dr. Roland for that matter. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Again, online IAFP education webpage for CME credit. And we hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates.